Please, I invite you to stand and join in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please call a roll.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer?
Here.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Here. The minutes for the September 21st meeting are not yet complete. We do have several changes to the agenda. Councilperson Peters, you have a request?
I wanted to move off the consent agenda R156-15 and R162-15.
Mr. Thomas?
Yeah, I'd like to remove R159-15.
Nauzer?
I'm requesting that R157 be removed from the agenda or consent agenda, and I need to abstain from R162-15 due to a conflict of interest.
We have a motion to allow Ms. Nauzer to abstain from 162.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Welcome to the meeting.
Hang on.
Wait, there's one other thing.
Oh, yeah, we have to vote on the
Well,
agenda.
You also are, staff is asking that you remove 163-15 from the agenda.
May I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. May I have a motion and a second to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Want to welcome everybody. There are several opportunities for public comment during the after the public hearing. We have public hearings, old business, new business. There's an opportunity to comment publicly. Each individual is entitled to 3 minutes. If you are a representative of a specific organization primarily involved in the issue, you may ask for and will be granted 5 minutes. We'll start with the special items. I'll ask Mr. Mathis, Ms. Amin, and Mr. Glasscock to meet at the podium.
I, John Dwayne Glasscock,
Do solemnly swear
that I possess all qualifications
for the office of Deputy City Manager
for the City of Columbia, Missouri
that I am not subject
to any of the disqualifications
set forth in the charter
of the City of Columbia
that I will support the Constitution
and the laws of the United States
and of the state of Missouri
and the charter and ordinances
of the city of Columbia
and that I will faithfully discharge
the duties of my office
so help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And can I have you sign?
Mr. Tad Johnson, would you come forward?
I, Tad Johnson.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I possess all qualifications.
That I possess all qualifications.
For the office of Director.
For the office of Director of Utilities.
For the City of Columbia, Missouri.
For the City of Columbia, Missouri.
That I am not subject.
That I am not subject.
To any of the disqualifications.
To any of the disqualifications.
Set forth in the Charter.
Set forth in the Charter.
Of the City of Columbia.
Of the City of Columbia.
That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
And laws of the United States.
And laws of the United States.
And of the State of Missouri.
And of the State of Missouri.
And the Charter and ordinances.
And the Charter and the ordinances.
Of the City of Columbia.
Of the City of Columbia.
And that I will faithfully discharge.
And I will faithfully discharge.
The duties of my office.
The duties of my office.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
And then can I have you sign this?
Mr. Dave Nichols, will you come forward, please?
I, David Nichols.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I possess all qualifications.
That I possess all qualifications.
For the office of Director.
For the office of Director of Public Works.
For the City of Columbia.
For the City of Columbia, Missouri.
That I am not subject.
That I am not subject.
To any of the disqualifications.
To any of the disqualifications.
Set forth in the Charter.
Set forth in the Charter.
Of the City of Columbia.
Of the City of Columbia.
That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
And laws of the United States.
And laws of the United States.
And of the State of Missouri.
And the State of Missouri.
And the Charter and ordinances.
And the Charter and ordinances.
Of the City of Columbia.
Of the City of Columbia.
And that I will faithfully discharge.
That I will faithfully discharge.
The duties of my office.
The duties of my office.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
When I announced the Mayor's Task Force on Pedestrian Safety, I appointed Syed as, and made it very clear at that point that he would be a temporary appointment. Therefore, I am now appointing Amy Wasowicz to fill that spot. We'll move to the public comment section, scheduled public comment. Those who contact the City Manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak at the beginning of that council meeting on any topic that's not on the agenda. Only three people can speak on the same topic. Tonight we have three requests. Each individual is entitled to 5 minutes. I want to point out that the council does not address these issues at the time the comments are made by the public, but that the council very likely might discuss these issues at the end of the meeting during a council comment section. I'll yield 5 minutes to Tracy Wilson-Kleekamp.
Good evening, Mayor and City Council members. I'm Tracy Wilson-Kleekamp, 2905 Greenbrier Drive, Columbia, Missouri. My brief discussion tonight is about diversity and inclusion, and before I make my remarks, I wanted to thank Ian Thomas and Mike Trapp for responding to Race Matters, our organization, who is going to persist in trying to have this dialogue in our community. It is difficult, but to make a cultural shift in how we think and believe and act, sometimes we just have to be squeaky and keep pushing, that those little wheels keep turning. So I'm going to open with a small quote. But before I make my quote, I want to say, here's my challenge in terms of diversity, and it is, how many worlds can you walk in besides your own with grace? Obviously, I'm black. I speak Spanish. I can walk in a couple of worlds besides my own, and I probably can fake it about four or five others because I'm comfortable being outside of my comfort zone. Why is that important? Because when we can't get out of our comfort zone, we have bad outcomes. We have achievement gap. We have mass incarceration. We have health disparities. We have things that cost us a lot of money because we're unwilling to work with people who are different than we are. So here's my quote. Obviously, I do believe in a colorblind society, but it has been and remains an aspiration. It is a goal toward which our society has progressed uncertainly, bearing as it does the enormous burdens of incalculable injuries inflicted by race prejudice and other bigotries which the law once sanctioned and even encouraged. Not having attained our goal, we must face the simple fact that there are groups in every community which are daily paying the cost of American injustice. Thurgood Marshall, Supreme Court Justice. So back to my comment about how many worlds can you walk in. It's also important so that when we talk about police and crime, we don't have our clutch response. What about black-on-black crime? What about those people? We have to be able to move beyond those comments. We also have to be able to think about how we engage conversation. So here's my formula. It's collaboration plus inclusion plus capacity equals diversity. So basically, we have to re-engineer what we think about diversity. It's like technology. We used to have mainframes, and we had minis. We got new software. We're always learning. We're relentlessly willing. We get new phones all the time. We have to learn something new. Diversity is the same way. It's never static. It always changes. So we have to be relentlessly willing to keep learning. So collaboration, it's not a checklist. A different strategy is needed for every situation. So like if you're an officer or a teacher, you have siblings or you have kids, they each have their own personality and special needs. But we have to be strategic about it so that we do no harm when we do it, all right? It requires that we have a lifelong approach. It means we have to be flexible, and it means we have to be willing to look at our own personal toolbox and see what's missing. Inclusion, are all the right people at the table? Are we operating in a silo? Are we thinking outside of the box? Do we get all the facts or do we really like some of the facts? Are we only comfortable with people who look like us? Being able to walk into other worlds gives us an opportunity to be included in experiences outside of our own. And lastly, capacity. Intellectual and human capital gives us the capacity to solve problems. There's no single application for this. It requires multiple approaches at the same time. So my challenge is, can we do that as a city and as a community? And it's important so that people don't feel they can say the N-word or make any kind of comment about anyone. And also that we have the skills to say, hey, I'm not going to accept those kind of remarks. That's unacceptable to me. We need that. So in closing, I will say, like many others who have gone before you, you must struggle against injustice with all your might. You must refuse to be racialized or to racialize others. But at the same time, you must live as if we were the world were otherwise. You must reach out and claim it as your own. I know that's a lot to ask. It will certainly require difficult heroism and subtle resistance, as well as exposure to the risk of being misunderstood by your peers and elders. But perhaps, just perhaps, when enough people do as you do, racism will indeed have no future. Thomas C. Holt. The challenge is, how many worlds can you walk in, and you can you lead others to do the same with grace? Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wilson-Cleghamp. I'll yield 5 minutes to Julie Laidhoff.
Hello, my name is Julie Laidhoff. I live at 1025 Lakeside Drive. I'm here to represent Race Matters. Nearing graduation with my Ed Specialist degree in counseling psychology from the University of Missouri this past spring, I chose for my capstone project the creation of a curriculum for a 16-week college course on the topic of white privilege as it relates to modern racism. During my work on the course, I read scholar after scholar asserting that most European-American whites are unaware of their privileged status in a society where white supremacy and institutionalized racism are the norm. In numerous disciplines, including social work, psychology, education, political science, and business, the message proclaiming the need for whites to examine their own racial privilege is being affirmed. What makes modern racism invisible to most whites is that it resides largely in our systems rather than in acts of personal prejudice. This modern form of racism, which followed on the heels of Jim Crow, is often defined or called colorblind racism, where most whites believe we are non-racist, while daily and in significant areas of our lives we benefit from privileges, or often a lack of disadvantage, simply based on our skin color. True, it is difficult to separate out class dynamics from race dynamics, but many scholars agree that race alone, separate from the element of social class, affords whites privileges in the areas of housing, education, healthcare, employment, and beyond. One element of society where modern racism plays out with devastating consequences for people of color is the criminal justice system. On August 20th of this year, Columbia's Police Department participated in a course created under the auspices of the Department of Justice. This course was called Procedural Justice for Law Enforcement Agencies, Organizational Change Through the Integration of Procedural Justice Core Principles in Decision-Making and Policies. The stated purpose of this course is to assist in the organizational transformation of a response-oriented police service to one based on policies that support community policing. Community policing is an entirely different paradigm than response-oriented policing. This transformation in police service is outlined in detail in the President's Task Force on Policing in the 21st Century, and it is reiterated in the Ferguson Commission report. The transformation to a community policing model rather than a response-oriented model is one of the recommendations stated in the Mayor's Task Force on Community Violence approved by this council last November. Trust, transparency, and community involvement are emphasized in the report as values to espouse in reducing violence. I'm here to urge the police department to make the transition from a service focused on responding to calls to a service that is proactive and focused on crime prevention. We of Race Matters have great confidence in the ability of our police department to make this change. Furthermore, the Citizens Handbook 2015 was mailed to Columbia residents in the final week of September. On page 42 of the handbook, Columbia's Police Department is described in the following ways. Officers, quote, focus on building relationships with citizens and businesses in efforts to solve problems, end quote. And what I just read is a description of community policing, and the handbook uses the community policing term to describe the model used by CPD. The handbook further describes the police department in the following way, quote, when concerns are communicated by citizens within a beat, officers develop problem-oriented policing, POP, projects as a response to the concerns and communicate the goals and outcomes of the projects to the residents, end quote. Race Matters is impressed by the significant departure from the way in which community policing was explained to five Race Matters members who met with the chief of police on June 3rd of this year. Just 4 months ago, the chief described community policing as the presence of two officers in Douglas Park with the hope of extending this to two other neighborhoods sometime soon. The nature of the relationship was described as knowing the color of the eyes of the business owners in the neighborhood and omitted any mention of solving problems or developing problem-oriented policing. Problem-oriented policing has never come up in conversations Race Matters has had with police officers. In order to fulfill the potential of the police department's new commitment stated in the Citizens Handbook on Problem-Oriented Policing, or POP, and community policing, we would ask City Council to support this new level of engagement in ways detailed by the current policy literature on community policing. Specifically, Race Matters requests, one, host a forum for CPD to outline this new model of policing, two, invite CPD to describe the POP projects they've developed as per page 42 in the Citizen Handbook. Three, ask CPD to inform those living in the highest crime areas to work with them in creating solutions that will address crime in their neighborhoods. Personally, as a lifelong resident of Columbia, I'm grateful for the abundant strengths of our community. I ask that our city leaders continue to take bold actions in leading Columbia toward greater justice for all its citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. I yield 5 minutes to Mary Hussman.
Mary Hussman, 210 Ridgeway. In 2009, the Massachusetts-based Gatso Corporation signed a council-approved five-year deal with Columbia. Gatso talks communities into installing red light cameras by claiming they'll improve safety. I think most Missourians believe that red light cameras are used not so much to improve safety, but to generate revenue. For each $120 ticket, Columbia gets $76 and Gatso $44. Initially, the cameras took pictures of the front plate and the driver. Gatso sent focused pictures to our police department, where officers tried to match them with a face on the owner's driver's license. If matched, a ticket was mailed to the alleged offender. Was not this desk job of comparing photos for fining a very poor use of our officers' professional experience and time? An officer out on the street ticketing a driver for running a red light would not have this identification problem. In August 2013, staff reported that the officers weren't consistently able to make these matches, and therefore the city was losing about $200,000 of money. At staff's urging, the council majority decided to just ticket the title owner. I was at this meeting. The report and discussion did not focus on safety improvement. It was all about money. Meanwhile, Missourians in other locations were taking offense at this title ticketing scheme. Some sued, and ultimately the case went to the Missouri Supreme Court last month. Our Supreme Court declared this method unconstitutional and also mandated that points be applied against a violator's driver's license. St. Louis, Kansas City, and other Missouri places are refunding money to car owners illegally title ticketed. One wonders how much money Columbia illegally generated and if the city will send refunds to those illegally charged. And here's something that the public is just learning about. You can now buy a product called Super Blocker Spray. You spray it on your license plate, then the plate looks normal to the naked eye, but if a photo is taken by a radar enforcement camera, the spray blocks out the plate, so it is unreadable. Let's move away from this punitive system. One positive way might be to offer driver's education classes free and available for all eligible Columbia adults. This would be a wonderful service to the public and would make our driving safer all over town and beyond. So will you believe Gatso's safety claims for our city, or will you recognize red light cameras for what they have become? A fear-mongering, high-tech, cash cow intrusion into our lives and pocketbooks. Finally, in 2015, the unpopularity of photo enforcement resulted in legislators in Jefferson City nearly passing bills that banned the cameras statewide or mandated a vote by Missourians. Council should at least wait until the end of the next legislative session when bills will again be filed to restrict red light cameras. If these bills become law, what repercussions would Columbia incur if we have roped ourselves into another five-year Gatso contract? Do what other cities have done. Vote no on red light cameras.
Thank you, Ms. Hussman. Please read item A and B, 280-15.
Agenda item A is the construction of water mains along portions of Molly Lane, Lakeland Drive, Linda Lane, and Sarah Ann Drive. Council Bill 280-15 is an ordinance declaring it is in the public interest to proceed with construction of water mains along portions of Molly Lane, Lakeland Drive, Linda Lane, and Sarah Ann Drive, approving the plans and specifications, determining that the work shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Steph?
This public hearing is for the upgrade of existing water distribution infrastructure in the Lakeland Acres neighborhood. The water distribution infrastructure in this area was acquired by Water and Light as part of the acquisition of Water District Number 2 a number of years ago. This project will install a new 8-inch main along Molly and new 6-inch mains along Lakeland, Linda Lane, and East Sarah Ann. The new water mains will be constructed in street right-of-way and will be located behind the curb. These upgraded mains will provide increased fire flows and include five new fire hydrants needed to provide adequate fire protection in the area. At this time, no customer water service transfer is planned as part of this project. Staff has contacted all adjacent property owners, and no negative comments have been received at this time. This project is estimated to cost $300,000 and has been appropriated in the budget under CIP project number WT-269. And with that, I'd like to answer any questions I can about this project.
A couple of questions I have. Were these mains put in prior to annexation in the city?
I don't believe these. This is actually in the city. I think this is just on the outside of the city. Typically what happens when we acquire water district pipes just outside the city, they pay a little bit more than the ones inside the city. So I think this one has a 15% water rate adder because it's still outside the city limits at this time, is I believe where it's at. It's just over the line.
I know that there had historically there's been an issue about lower standards outside of city limits. Has that been pretty much rectified so that infrastructure construction outside of the city limits now conforms to what we do? Because otherwise, I don't think we want to be in the pattern of taking over substandard infrastructure and having stakeholders in the city having to upgrade it.
Gotcha. Certainly there's a difference between what, you know, rural water supply districts and what we do as a metropolitan water utility, but the primary difference is really fire protection. When you go to a Columbia's water system that's kind of to be annexed or will be in the city limits, there's a fire protection expectation that goes along with that area, and this is really what this project is doing. Like I said, from just potable water supply, we're not transferring any potable water. This project is really a fire protection project. Now, as the old water lines do wear out, then they would be transferred to these new lines, but that's not part of this project. It's all about fire protection here.
Any other questions by council?
You don't have to upgrade these new lines, though?
Not for potable water supply, but for fire protection we do. The existing lines are like 3 or 4 inch lines, which is fine for potable water, drinking water, but that won't even get close on fire protection. We need 8 and 6 inch lines to be able to have fire protection here.
Okay, so when the potable water lines are old, then we can just transfer the water. The water that's coming through the lines will be coming through the ones we're laying now.
That's correct. And the ones we're laying are down by the streets. The current ones that are supplying are in the backyard, so we'll choose not to dig up the old backyards and replace those. We'll just transfer them to in front of the house.
Okay, thank you.
Ted, did you say that these customers pay 15% higher rates?
It's typical for customers that come in that are outside the city limits but are like water district people that come in that we take over, that the rates vary. In this particular case, with the agreement that's put in place, it is just a shade over 15% as a rate, as a adder to it.
And that'll continue forever, or?
As far as I know, it continues until they're annexed.
Until they're annexed.
Just a question, too. This is also, this is the northeast side of town. This is in Ward 3. It's also in that area that is, it's contiguous with the city limits. It's right on that borderline with Rice Road and Lake of the Woods Road, that kind of thing. And it's also in that area that is slated to be annexed by virtue of Battle High School and so on. To some degree, that's going to continue to grow. It's been identified in some of the plans that we've had. In this case, I mean, I think in terms of firefighting capacity, that's absolutely essential in terms of public safety for these improvements to proceed.
Yeah, I think our service territory kind of goes over to Lake of the Woods Golf Course and north, and that's about where our line lands.
Any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak? Seeing none, any discussion by council?
Well, I'll just comment that in many ways this is similar to new development in Columbia, that we do apply a connection fee to in order to bring the water service up to our city standards. We're investing, is it $300,000 in this project? Is that the correct number?
Yes, it is.
But I think to some extent the fact that they're paying a higher rate mitigates that. But I just wanted to kind of point that out, that this is an expense that we wouldn't have if we were not adding these customers to our municipal water service.
Any other discussion?
Just a comment, and although I agree with that concept entirely in terms of new capacity, this has also been an established area, and this is really in a place that we don't have connection fees in place for this enhanced safety factor that is required for extra water. I mean, that's not to say that we shouldn't go there, I agree with you philosophically. But in this case, I don't think it's the kind of burden that we can lay at the, in this particular area.
If there's no more discussion, please call the roll for B-280-15.
Council Bill 280-15 is an, Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. David?
Yes. Please read 245-15.
Council Bill 245-15 is an ordinance amending Chapter 14 of the City Code to revise the speed limit on portions of Providence Road and State Route K and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective.
Staff, please.
Council tabled this legislation to allow time for staff to obtain a copy of MoDOT's speed study related to their recommendation to lower the speed limit from 55 miles per hour to 45 miles per hour on State Route K between Scott Boulevard and Coneflower Avenue. Council also had concerns as to how MoDOT would notify the public of the speed limit reduction. Per John Schaefer, MoDOT Senior Traffic Studies Specialist, crash history, presence of pedestrians and bicyclists, the number of access points, and actual vehicle speeds were all considered in determining the reduced speed limit recommendation. A copy of this speed study is attached to the supplemental report. Mr. Schaefer also indicated that message boards will be placed on Route K for a week, combined with press release prior to change in speed limits to notify residents. Staff conducted a similar speed study on North Providence Road between Vandiver Drive and Blue Ridge Road, which is currently posted at 35 miles per hour. This section of road recorded the 85th percentile speed of 48.27 miles per hour. Due to a limited number of access points, no residential driveways, and adequate pedestrian facilities, staff recommends that the speed limit be raised to 45 miles per hour in this section. Artificially, low speed limits can create a larger variation of speeds driven along the roadway, so when a speed limit is properly set, traffic flows improves and there are fewer accidents. Be happy to answer any questions.
Council?
Dave, the current situation before we make any changes here is that east of Coneflower is 45 and west is currently from Coneflower to Scott 55. Is that correct?
That's right. I was thinking we had 50 mile an hour up to, 55, currently 55 the whole way to Coneflower.
It's currently 55 the whole way. And the proposal is to reduce it to 45 from Coneflower west to Scott?
Not 55 all the way, because it's 45 past High Point Lane, right up in that area. I can't tell you exactly where it picks up 45, but you take a right on High Point right after there's a 45-minute speed limit sign.
No, that's fine. You have firsthand knowledge of this. I have not been down there, certainly not recently. This bill refers to the section from Coneflower to South Scott and talks about reducing it from 55 to 45. So presumably it's currently 55. I mean, what I'm interested in is what is the section of Route K east of Coneflower out to Providence or whatever that's called? Is that...
That was 55.
That is 55.
Yes.
So why not reduce that whole section? Because there's actually a lot more residential development in that section east from Coneflower to the east. And I realize this isn't yours. This is MoDOT's.
Yeah. This is Richard Stone. He's traffic studies engineer for us. Yeah.
Thanks.
MoDOT, their studies indicated that in that section the speeds are higher. So they were concerned mostly with that section from Coneflower to basically where it turns into Providence. They thought if they could reduce that because of some of the curves and some of the collisions that they noted, that they could make an impact on those, specifically because of the design characteristics of the road or lack of design characteristics of the road.
So as a traffic engineer, how would you characterize the impact that changing the speed limit on this or any other section of road affects the speeds people actually drive? Because I sometimes hear that whatever you set the speed limit doesn't really make any difference to how fast people drive.
In this particular case, the operating speeds of the traffic right now are pretty close to what they're suggesting they be set at. That's one of the reasons why they have that break point where they keep part of it at 55 and then the rest of it they change to 45, because those operating speeds are actually pretty close to that recommended speed limit now, what they're planning on setting.
I'm looking at the data that John Schaefer provided, And location 3, east of Old Plank Road, Sinclair Road, has a median speed of 50, and 4, east of Boone's Crossing, has a median speed of 52. Those are the high speeds that they want to try to tailor down by reducing the speed limit signs to 45.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the if you see the supplemental information, the pace speed, what we call the pace speed, is actually a pretty good indicator, too. That means that the majority of cars are in a 10-mile-an-hour window. And if you look at where those are, that 45-mile-an-hour basically captures them a little bit higher, 5-mile-an-hour or so range.
But you're hoping to, or they're hoping to pull them down a bit, whereas the other two locations, north of Bethel Church and east of Maple Meadows, which are in the section east of Coneflower, have lower median speeds, 47 and 46. Let me just ask that question again. The diagram seems to indicate to me that from Coneflower going east, the current speed limit already is 45. Is that not what that's showing, those red arrows? And
That's the proposed speed.
Well, I don't think so, because the change is going to be west of Coneflower, isn't it? Unless I'm completely misunderstanding this. I thought the
change will be from Scott Boulevard to Coneflower.
From South Scott.
Yeah. Scott, where the Scott Boulevard
which is
just
west of
pushed
Coneflower,
through
isn't
on Decay. Coneflower is up towards Providence.
Yeah, so.
Yes, you're correct.
And
sorry,
after Coneflower, it's 45.
Yes, you are correct.
Okay, so it is 45.
Correct.
All right, that makes more sense. So it's 45, and it's achieving 47 and 46, and we're going to change the section west to Scott Boulevard from 55 to 45 and hope to bring down that 50 and 52. All right, I'm really just trying to understand what the, you know, strategy is and how these speeds are set.
It would seem to me, actually, that you ought to be consistent here, and if you have a lower speed limit on the section that's east of where we're talking about, then you ought to make it consistent with the speed limit that's on the west, and that would be probably the most optimize the kind of result that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, unless the character of the road changes dramatically, but I don't think it does it?
Well, there's just more development that's increased along Route K. There's many subdivisions that are now,
which is even more compelling to reduce the speed limit to some degree to mm-hmm. make it more consistent, I would think.
It would be, I think it's, correct me, it would be more consistent with city ordinances on speeds through our roadway system. Because right now it's a state road.
Yeah, the way the ordinances are, our ordinances are written and state law is written is basically MoDOT sets the speed limit and our ordinances reflect what they set them at.
You know, I just have a concern just because before Scott Boulevard, it's still going to remain 55. And so you're going to have and right there where it turns, there's a straightaway stretch where I just don't see people reducing their speed because you're coming from 55, 60, then you're going to hit that straightaway. People are still going to be, as you can see, that's probably one, section 4 to 3 is probably one of the higher speeds. And you don't slow down until you start getting into more residential areas. And so who asked for this? I mean, it said on here, our office was asked to review speed limits on Route K. I mean, so who did MoDOT?
MoDOT was, they were reviewing it as part of their periodic review of roadways.
Is it worth asking MoDOT to consider that? You know more about this piece than certainly I do. And is it worth asking MoDOT to consider the piece that does connect with Scott Boulevard to make this entirely consistent?
We can certainly do that, yes. I mean, if you would like
would
for
seem,
us to do that.
Would seem to be the reasonable thing to do at this point. I mean, we have to decide on this piece, but it seems to me that when you're starting to change speed limits on established roadways, that the less speed changes you have, the better off that you are.
To some degree, yes.
I would certainly support talking to MoDOT to have that entire piece from McBain all the way.
So you're talking about further west.
Further
of the
west,
Scott.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because especially now with all of the construction that's going to go on for the next period of time, people coming off of Route KK onto K, there's not a lot of sight distance, I don't believe. And so you're pulling out, and that's a very strange angled access point, I guess, for lack of a better term, when you have to get onto K from KK, if you've ever been out there. It's not a straight intersection. You kind of have to make a loop before you can merge on. And so it kind of skews your distance and perspective. So
we can make this change in the hopes of asking MoDOT to consider the rest of it.
We will. We will touch base with MoDOT traffic engineers and ask them to review that as a request from council.
Does anyone in the public want to speak? Any more council discussion? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 245-15, Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes. Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 273-15, 274-15, 275-15, 276-15, 277-15, 278-15, 279-15, and resolutions 153-15, 154-15, 155-15, 158-15, 160-15, and 161-15.
Please call the roll.
Bills 273-15, 274-15, 275-15, 276-15, 277-15, 278-15, 279-15, and resolutions 153-15, 154-15, 155-15, 158-15, 160-15, and 161-15. Mr. Ruffin?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions except resolution 162-15, of which I abstain.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes. We'll move to new business. Please read 156-15.
Council Bill 156-15 is a resolution authorizing the city manager to execute agreements with various cultural organizations, authorizing agreements of up to $750 per agreement for arts programming or services for cultural organizations.
Staff, please.
This legislation authorizes 24 contracts with local arts and culture organizations for a total of $100,000 in annual funding and establishes a budget threshold of $3,000 for small request funding awarded throughout the year. Be happy to answer any questions.
I actually asked this to be pulled off because,
Hey, Betsy.
Forward, back. did this come up in August?
Yes. Yeah, the process is we have an August report that our – thank you, sir. Appreciate it – that our chair of our Commission of Cultural Affairs comes out and basically announces that the commission itself has made recommendations for funding and that we have to wait until the beginning of the fiscal year to actually put those contracts into place at this point. So this is the authorization to have these contracts happen.
Okay, so and that did not come to the City Council before. That was a report.
Yes, yeah, that was a comment basically from the chair of the commission, thanking the City Council for their support for the upcoming contracts to come.
Okay, thank you.
Sure thing.
I just had a question. I'm fascinated by this because there are 24 projects here, and I'd just enlighten me as to how the commission achieves this goal of $100,000 in the end, and these requests are granted on the base to the dollar. To make, does the commission actually consider these? Well, I'm sure they do. Otherwise, they wouldn't recommend them. But that's kind of a fascinating process.
It's not, and that would actually be really fascinating. We would love to do that. No, all of the requests that you see here in front of you, as far as the dollar allocation that's been recommended for them, in most cases is not the actual full dollar amount that they requested. When they these organizations can apply for up to $10,000 worth of consideration. And then the Commission on Cultural Affairs goes through a pretty lengthy process reviewing all the applications, and then they score them. And then we use a formula that Missouri Arts Council has used for years where we could take all of those scores, put them into a spreadsheet, and work them down through a series of eliminations until we reach the dollar amount that we actually are allowed to give out.
And that model actually calculates to the dollar with that budget. Right?
Yes.
Wow.
Not to the dollar amount to what they requested, but to the dollar amount of what it is. Yes.
Right. Yeah, thank you.
Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any more discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 15615, Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Snauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes. 15715.
Council Bill 15715 is a resolution authorizing a software service agreement with Recollect Systems Incorporated relating to solid waste and recycling activities for city utility customers.
Staff?
In response to City of Columbia residents wanting more information and education concerning recycling activities within the City of Columbia, staff is proposing a software service agreement with Recollect Systems. The software provides numerous features, including how to reach recycling diversion rate goals, collection day reminders, notification when route schedules have been changed due to holidays or severe weather. A Waste Wizard component of the software also allows customers to simply type in an item or a product to determine if the material can be recycled. The software can be accessed from Solid Waste Division's existing website or a free mobile app is available for smartphone users. The cost of the two-year service agreement is $25,998 and will be paid for from the Solid Waste Division's recycling account. I'll be happy to answer any questions council may have.
I requested this be pulled off for a couple reasons. First, I saw that this company's out of Canada, correct? Is there any American companies that provide this service? I mean, how did we come up with Recollect?
I believe we went out and looked for probably the cheapest model, Ms. Nauzer, and this is about the cheapest we could find to do this service. We did talk to IT, and they could not provide a service except within 3 years because of some of our ERP stuff that they're currently working on.
Okay. So what are our goals with this product? I mean, do we have a number of households that we're trying to grab? I'm just reading, skimming through again through the LACE study.
When we had the ward meetings that we went out to, the residents was asking for more information about diversion rates and how they could be better informed when routes are changed due to weather or holidays. And so we have some of this in transit. Like with our Double Map app, we get social media out to them, and they know when buses are running late. We thought the same thing here with this software package for solid waste.
I just had a question. I know there are a few folks out there that don't have smartphones that might want to access some of this information. Did you say that this is also accessible via the internet through the website?
Through
and
our
so
existing
on?
Website.
This information is available in addition to just smartphone apps.
Correct.
I just underscore that from the contact center perspective, who now takes calls for solid waste, it ties for number one source of phone calls to the city with transit. So they're calling about where's the bus and where can I get the Double Map app. And they're calling about, do you pick up garbage today? Is this the holiday? So there's a huge volume of calls about that. So one thought is if we can get an app out there, we can actually reduce the number of calls and drive that contact to the cheapest channel.
And it also enhances our educational component. We educate on recycling all the time, go out to schools and those kind of things. This is just another tool in the toolbox that we're trying to get to see if it works.
And I will just be sarcastic this evening and say I do see a picture from Olathe and they have roll carts. My humor for the evening.
Would anyone from the public like to speak? Any more council discussion? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 15715, Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes. 15915.
Council Bill 15915 is a resolution authorizing an agreement for professional engineering services with Bartlett and West Incorporated for a preliminary and final design of the Forum Boulevard and Green Meadows Road intersection roundabout project.
Staff, please.
The Forum Boulevard Green Meadows intersection was identified in the 2015 CIP ballot. This legislation authorizes an agreement with Bartlett and West to provide preliminary plans, right-of-way plans, final plans and specifications, bid phase services, and construction phase services. The project includes the design of a dual-lane roundabout with concrete pavement and sidewalks, stormwater improvements, striping, and signage. The agreement is for a not-to-exceed amount of $99,500 and will be funded by the capital improvement sales tax. The project is anticipated to begin construction this fall, 2016. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions by council?
Yeah. What is the primary purpose of this project?
It's relieve of congestion at that intersection. The corridor experiences quite a bit of congestion at this particular location.
And a typical roundabout kind of processes traffic like 30% better than a four-way stop or something like
that? I'd say that's probably right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's we're going to analyze that through this process.
And it's also, I think what I've seen is that pedestrian safety is
correct.
Improved at a roundabout rather than pedestrians trying to cross at a four-way stop.
That's correct. Those offsets are further back away from the intersection.
Right. Good. Did Bartlett and West also design the roundabout at Fairview and Rollins, or have they designed any other roundabouts in Columbia for us?
No, they have the form bed ped bridge at the bottom of the hill. They've designed that for
us. Which we haven't built yet.
No.
But that's coming
up
pretty soon.
We just acquired the last easement, I think the last meeting. So we'll be putting a bid out for this winter to start on the bridge.
Okay. So they haven't designed roundabouts for us before. This will be their first one.
Not that I remember, no.
Okay. I would be interested if you could send me references for roundabouts they have designed.
Okay.
That would be helpful.
They're a major firm
right.
with offices in many states. So
yeah. We'll okay. I'd appreciate that, Dave. Thanks.
That's a good point. And just to follow up on that point, this idea about roundabouts, since we're in this mode, and I certainly think they're an improvement in many places in our community, but sometimes the public is worried about the fact that there are different designs, whether or not there is, in some cases, roundabouts are designed so that the emergency stuff is on the outside, some is on the inside. We generally go with the inside, but it would be interesting to know that these are consistent, to the extent to which these are consistent with the roundabouts that we already have that is not, doesn't provide a...
We do provide them with the examples that we've had in place
so
already.
They take that into consideration.
Yes, they do.
And the other question I had is this, in fact, was a placeholder in the CIP?
Yes, it was.
Right.
Real quick question. Are you done?
Yeah, I'm
done. I'm sorry. Since this is in the 5th Ward and I'm very familiar with this intersection because my children went to the preschool right there on the corner, and this is probably one of the most complained about intersections with constituents for pedestrian safety. And there's always seems to be some kind of minor fender bender in that area. But looking at the area in itself and then comparing it to some of our newer roundabouts, this is not going to be anything along the line of the Fairview roundabout.
Oh, no.
Because I'm just looking at the space that's allowable there on the corner, with people's yards and the parking lot for the daycare.
Right, and we actually do have a dual lane roundabout at Clark Lane and... Okay. Is it Lick the Woods? It's
yeah.
So
yeah.
It is designed such that when that volume is such, we just expand to the inside. We won't have to move any other utilities or any other.
I can't wait till we convert that into a dual lane roundabout and see how that works.
It's set up just to remove pavement and it's ready to go. So that's but we feel like this one will probably function as a dual lane, but we're going to study that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Can I ask why we aren't using the same folks we've used before? I mean, what's the reason for changing engineering companies?
They are a very qualified engineering firm that has produced and provided plans and specs on time for every project that we've had with them. They're able to put a project together in the time frame that we need, and so they have shown that qualification that is critical. We think in this particular case, because we've got corridors coming on both legs of this, at Nifong and on Forum in the future. So if we can get this built before we can move forward with the other projects, we feel like it'll relieve a lot of congestion that
could have come about with those other projects.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Cliff Drive. There was talk about a roundabout in lieu of the building the bridge. And has that been discounted, or is that still in the possibility? I think Ian talked
as,
about
different
that.
Thank you. As I understand it, the funding for the forum expansion stayed pretty much the same in the ballot question, and the ballot was passed. So at the moment, the forum project is on the capital improvement plan, and it has funding. From a personal point of view, I would like to continue to explore the possibility of reducing the scope of that project using roundabouts. This is one roundabout that could actually help with that. But
was part of this bill the bridge also?
No, this bill is only about this roundabout at this intersection. Anyone else?
Steve Wendling, office at 555 East Green Meadows, Suite 9. And I just want to say I'm an advocate of the roundabouts. I personally built one right there. I would just like to make sure, though, that it does remain open to traffic and it's not, you know, doesn't shut the traffic off like it does out on Scott Boulevard with the new roundabout being built.
No, I think we'll probably have to end up getting this built in phases such that the traffic will be utilizing the intersection.
Anyone else? Any discussion by council?
Well, I think this is an excellent spot for a roundabout. It does improve flow of traffic, and it also brings traffic down to a very appropriate speed for this area. I think, in my understanding of effective roundabouts, it's important that there is a what some people call a terminating vista, some kind of a high structure in the middle of the roundabout. It could be landscaping, it could be public art, something that makes the roundabout visible from a distance. And that is one of the complaints that I hear about the Fairview and Rollins roundabout, that drivers don't really see it coming, and then they end up pretty much driving straight through at a high speed, which I think is a problem. But I think this is a good location. I look forward to seeing the roundabouts that Bartlett and West have designed in the past.
Well, the size of the Fairview and Rollins roundabout is so small, it's almost like a speed bump rather than a roundabout. And frankly, I mean, in terms of that vista and something in the middle, I mean, the epitome of that would be the Arc de Triomphe in France, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. a huge roundabout, but that's a great idea.
I'll just simply say for skeptics of roundabouts, I'd urge you to do a YouTube search on Mythbusters. Roundabouts, a nice little demonstration on the effectiveness of roundabouts over four-way stops. Any other discussion?
I just have one question. There's so many complaints about the roundabout on Fairview. Is there ever any possibility of just taking it out?
We really haven't had that much accident reports. Mm-hmm. I think the initial complaints were high, but we have really not heard much lately about that. I think people are getting acclimated to it. Mm-hmm. It does serve the function for that location, and we did not put a typical roundabout in there because we would have had to move major water lines and bought homes. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a side project with a sidewalk project that was initially to get the students along Fairview to the school. And so we kind of combined those two together to help pedestrian flow in that area. But at this time, we haven't had any plans to change that out.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 159-15, Mr. Ruffin.
Yes.
Mr. Trapp.
Yes.
Ms. Scala.
Yes.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer.
Yes.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Mr. McDavid.
Yes. Please read 162-15.
Council Bill 162-15 is a resolution consenting to the issuance of a state license for the sale of intoxicating liquor at the Clean Cut Barbershop LLC located at 510 East Green Meadows Road, Suite 105.
Staff, please.
This is a request due to Section 311.080 of state statute that requires written permission of the City Council prior to the issuance of a license within 100 feet of a childhood learning center.
And in accordance with the state statute, we have in stamped written and asked written consent from the all of the property owners that were located in this area. So we've sent certified mail to the four property owners in this area. Any questions we would entertain?
Did you say you have written permission from the property owners, or you notified the property owners?
We notified them. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there any other barber shops in this community that have liquor licenses?
Yes, there's one.
There is.
Really?
Yes.
Is that for the as we've discussed? Is that for the barber or the clients? I mean, in terms of
the clients. I would assume.
Well, my question is, do we normally give liquor licenses to anybody within 100 feet of churches or nurseries or daycares? I mean, is this a common thing in Columbia, and this is just sort of a something that we just have to rubber stamp, or is this unusual?
It's somewhat unusual. We've had several businesses that liquor establishments that have been 100 feet within a church or a daycare center, and we have brought them before council for approval, and they have been approved.
Okay.
We haven't had very many, just several during the past 7 or 8 years.
So the Academy of Early Childhood Learning was notified of?
Yes.
But they weren't, so no one asked their opinion or?
The
just a certified letter saying this person is pursuing this thing.
The communication said that it was going to be discussed at the council meeting tonight, and we received the receipt from the owner of the academy stating, you know, which showed that they received the communication.
And I only heard, I got an email saying that one person had a child at the early childhood place thought that it was a bad idea, but his child's only going to be there for 6 more months, so he didn't want to really make a big stink about it. That's the only thing I've heard. It was just an odd thing to come up.
After the public hearing, or public comment, rather, I'm going to make an amendment to table this, because I'm glad you pulled this from the consent agenda. I missed it, and I'd like to see it and kind of get a feel for the place or hear an argument, you know, just granted, just because, I mean, I'm not of a mind to, there's a good reason why we don't want these establishments within 100 feet of schools. If someone doesn't make a case why it shouldn't apply in this case, I'm not of a mind to grant it, but I at least want to give the applicant a chance to show up and make a case, and I'd like to go out and see it. So, but I'll make that motion after public comment.
Would anyone from the public like to speak?
My name is Steve Wendling. My office is at 555 East Green Meadows, suite number 9, and I'm the landlord of the building that they're requesting the variance on. And I'm also the owner of the Academy of Early Childhood Learning, and I own the building that the Academy's in. So what they're requesting is for an ancillary addition to a business that they're going to have of cutting hair. It's not meant to be it's not meant to be a beer joint or liquor establishment of any kind, or I'll be the first one to shut the lights off. But so I just want to stand up here and tell you I do support it. If I'm not mistaken, it's like 90 feet from the preschool building to their back door. So it's very, very close. Any questions?
So what's the reason that they want to be able just to serve beer to their customers that are getting a haircut? Or
marketing, I guess. Ingenious, huh?
Hi, my name is DJ Bishop. I'm a co-owner of the Clean Cut Barbershop, and this is Stephanie Murray. And we are seasoned hairstylists in the city of Columbia. We've been servicing our clients here for 5 years for me.
8 years.
8 years for her. And we both have managed male hair salons here in town, and now we are opening this small business, and it's under 5% alcohol. So it's just, and that I think equates to 6.3% by volume. So it's just beer, it's just wine, and we have a 2-drink maximum. So it's mostly set up for like when they're waiting, so they, you know, can just kind of chill out and have a beer.
Thank you. Any questions from council? Thank you.
For moms, too.
Rick Shanker, 1829 Cliff Drive. I've not been to the barber lately. But I serve on Buildings and Codes Commission. A lot of times we have these kind of appeals or proposals, and we are 10 feet off one way or 10 feet off another. These people wouldn't even be here if it was 10 feet further back. So, and I don't, since these people have expressed their intention, I think you should grant this appeal or this variance to the rule. Thank you.
Anyone else? Council discussion? Yes, go ahead.
Steve Wendling again. You brought up if there was one parent. We do have currently 106 families that attend the preschool, and my wife has approximately 80 students that attend her dance academy, and this is the only objection I'd heard of before that. And I'm in and out of my preschool all the time.
Thank you.
Well, you make your intentions before the public comment, because then people know what how to reflect it. So, and I think that's not a high bar with what they're trying to do, pardon the pun. And I think they met it, that in the absence of anybody coming out, I'm okay with supporting this tonight.
Yeah.
You know, Betsy makes a persuasive case.
I was going to comment if you made the motion and it's or the amendment and it succeeded, but I mean, I would just like the other information on the other place that has this, because I think this is so unusual to see this that I'm curious, and I'm not familiar with why we have another. Not that I'm opposed to this in any way. Matter of fact, I almost wish you had a little. You could serve wine rather than just beer. I'm not much of a beer person.
They will.
Oh, they will.
Yes.
Well, maybe I'll get my. Well, I don't get that many. But at any rate, I I'd like that information, regardless of how this turns out. I mean, just to see what the other instance is that this has happened. So.
And I think this sounds like a perfectly good idea. It reminds me of a place that used to be, maybe still is, in Nashville. It was called Harvey Washbangers, and it was a combined laundry, public laundry, and bar. So whilst your washing was doing, you could go and get a beer.
Well, we actually had one of that.
Oh,
one of these, a washateria that served alcohol in town here as well. I would be less inclined to support something that was a range, a pistol range, and which is actually, frankly, that's funny, but it's going on in lots of places in this country.
Please call the roll.
Council Bill 16215, Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes. Please read R16315.
Council Bill... Oh, sorry. That one's the one that's been removed.
You removed that one.
Yes, that was removed from the agenda.
Great. Let's move to introduction first reading. Please read the bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 281-15, 282-15, 283-15, 284-15, 285-15, 286-15, 287-15, 288-15, 289-15, 290-15, 291-15, 292-15, 293-15, and 294-15, first reading.
The first report is 9615, which is letters of support for a complete intersection policy. Staff?
We are delivering to council this evening letters from the Bicycle and Pedestrian Commission, joined by the Public Transit Advisory Commission, or PTAC, and the Disabilities Commission, all three urging council to think of complete intersections as part of our complete streets policy. So every leg of an intersection that's built has complete facilities for pedestrians and the disabled. to cross safely through those intersections. I think that's what the aim is for. But we're really just delivering those that correspondence to you.
A question I have is, are they asking for legislation? Because I know Mr. Thomas brought this very issue up at the intersection of Stadium Boulevard and Old 63, and we basically incorporated it as understanding. Does it require legislation, or does it require consensus?
Well, I would argue that it requires legislation. We have a complete streets policy. A lot of us worked very hard on that from 2000 to 2004 to define what a complete street was in terms of providing equitable access for automobile drivers, pedestrians, cyclists, young people, old people, people with disabilities, so that people could navigate the community safely and effectively. And we said at that time that the next step was to create a complete intersections concept so that these intersections didn't remain barriers. And I think what the Bicycle Pedestrian Commission is doing here is asking us to really complete the work that the council did in 2004 by adding intersections into the complete streets policy, or the street design standards, I think, as we called it then. My question to you two is whether you can envision how to write that into code and add it to the existing street design standards code in the Book of Ordinances.
Staff would like the chance to write a report on this with some of our thoughts, so we would like an opportunity to respond. It came through planning office, and the Public Works would like to have a chance to review the report and come back with some of our thoughts and comments about that as well. Mandating a policy without some flexibility gives us a little concern about that and some of the legs that that might be troublesome for us in certain locations. So we'd like to bring back a report to you if that'd be possible.
Yeah, I think that would be great, and I'd like to ask for that report. And
okay.
You volunteered it
anyway.
I'll just add a couple other bits of information through the kind of forum of the Mayor's Pedestrian Safety Task Force. A couple of members of the task force have actually timed how long it takes to get from the northeast to the northwest corner of the intersection of Bernadette and Stadium Boulevard, which is one of the MoDOT intersections that only has three pedestrian crossing legs. And one of those people was James Beattie, the senior highway engineer for MoDOT, who's on the task force. And he was rather surprised to find that it took him 5.5 minutes to make that traverse across three legs. The other person was Rachel Rulin, who's on a couple of our commissions. And when she did it, it took her 9.5 minutes. You know, setting up intersections that are so difficult for pedestrians to traverse is going to encourage people to take risks and use a crossing that is not protected, as well as it provides just a terrible level of service for pedestrians. So I would encourage you to consider that in reviewing these letters from the commissions and making some recommendations to us.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Scott.
Just a clarification. I remember when, in 2004, when I was actually a part of that street standards group along with Jerry Wade and a few other folks, and I just maybe need a little clarification. At the time, I guess we came up with a conclusion, although we drafted this street standard business, which I thought was a pretty good piece of work. We were kind of an incomplete streets group because we tended to avoid the intersections because we didn't have the in-house expertise to do that at the time, and we were deferring, and I think we were waiting until we got to a place where we could get the intersections. So I guess what I'm asking is, I mean, how do you see this? I'm not sure I understand exactly. We do have the street standards in place. We never really had a complete streets ordinance, did we? I mean, it wasn't called that. It was part of the street standards.
Yeah, CATSO now has a complete streets
CATSO does.
Policy, and that's you know, we are part of CATSO. Also, the street standards that you reference, those are what I would term a complete streets code. In other words, new development of new intersections is always going to be complete street and complete intersection. I think it's when we're in these retrofit
That's correct.
Situations where an intersection capacity is being upgraded, and historically there have not been complete crossings.
By no means am I suggesting that's a bad idea. I'm just trying to get this sorted out in my head in terms of what.
I think it's those major road intersection projects that this correspondence is targeting.
Yeah, and for the most part, that is correct. I want to be able to just bring back some analysis in where maybe it may not be always in the best interest for all the legs. And if you have a high turning movement with vehicles, would be opposed to or in conflict with pedestrians, we just need to analyze that and say there may be some situations that you want to get that turning movement cleared out and send the pedestrians on the other side of where that conflict would be. And so we have some situations like that that we
and
want.
That was the function of that pedestrian scramble as well, wasn't it? Then?
In some ways, yeah.
Tim, I think I heard you say, and I don't think it was accurate just then, that the current street design standards does require complete streets and complete intersections at all intersections. MoDOT comes in and says they only want us to build two crosswalks, then we had to kind of fight them on that.
No, the only point I was making, Councilman, was that if we're laying out a subdivision on a undeveloped tract of ground, all the intersections are going to be complete. I mean, there's going to be four-cornered crossings at those new intersections, and that's because we have street standards that require pedestrian and bike facilities, as well as through lanes and parking lanes on certain streets. It's when we're dealing with high-capacity roads that you get into these trade-offs, because you might have an intersection upgrade where there's going to be some dialogue about where those pedestrian facilities are accommodated and how and at what costs.
Well, just to sort of, interpret what I think that these commissions are saying, bicycle, pedestrian, public transit, and disabilities, is that we should not be reducing the level of service for pedestrians, even when we're doing these high-capacity upgrades like Bernadette and Stadium, and restricting pedestrian movements in those. As part of your report, Dave, if you could inventory all of the intersections in Columbia that currently have pedestrian crossing access at less than all of the possible legs. And I know Bernadette and Stadium is one, Old 63 at Broadway is another one, and I'm pretty sure there are several others. And explain why you feel that's necessary in each of those cases. Or maybe if you don't, then that would be great as well.
Okay.
If it can be changed.
Okay.
I have a question about one specific intersection at Rangeline and Vandiver. I started having my office hours at the Waffle House. I like to walk down there. And to get to my house, I have to cross the street, so I'm on the sidewalk side. And then I want to cross back. There's only one marked crossing out of the four. I never really noticed that until I realized that I can't get back across Vandiver to get to the Waffle House. You can only cross Rangeline, but if you want it, there's no none of the other. So there's only one out of the four. How is that? How am I supposed to? I cross mid-block.
Well, we'll include that in our list.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, right. Sure. I mean, I could, three, I thought, because you got to cross.
I don't know.
Instead of going across, but there's you can't get there from here. So anyway, there's my dilemma. If you see me illegally crossing, I just took an oath to support the law, but I got to get to where I'm going.
Just don't get hit.
Well,
you can name the Mike Trapp Memorial Crosswalk after me.
We'd rather not.
Without discussing the health benefits of waffles. we'll move to the next report, which is 97, which is an overview of the parking system enforcement. I sort of brought this up because I understand that the municipal court deals with the violations and then rules on the violations. But I have never really been comfortable with a follow-up on that. And I think this is validating my concern. It goes back to, and I don't have documentation on this, but I believe there was a time 5 or 6 years ago when the council published a list of people with outstanding parking. And there were people who were just getting parking tickets and stuffing them. And there was a person who had over 100 who I think whose name was known in the community. So we know that when the university issues a parking permit, the student will pay if she wants her diploma. But we have no such incentive. And so I just wanted to make sure that we are following up on citations, because it's awfully easy to ignore them. I think what this report is telling me is that we really don't have a good system for that, because it looks to me like a third of the tickets are not being paid. But I view a ticket as an accounts receivable, you know, and it has a time value. And an accounts receivable over a year is probably not going to get paid. And I think the finance department needs to be involved in this. This is computer generated. And I believe that when a enforcement officer encounters somebody with their fourth violation, they have over 30, they have three tickets over 90 days, and there's a fourth one, I believe they should be towed on the spot because they're not paying. And again, the general public, I understand, views parking tickets as a nuisance, because we all get them and we all hate them when we get one, right? But again, just those of us in the council know this, but just to reiterate this to the public, we restrict parking because if we didn't, students would store their cars on Ninth Street. It'd be like New York City, where you cannot find a place to park. You just store your car, or if you come to class, you park on Broadway and walk to class, and areas of commerce would have no place for customers to go. There's no place to park to go to lunch. So that's why we enforce parking meters, and we ought to charge enough that 15% of the spaces are open. And we ought to penalize those who don't pay. And this extends into neighborhoods, too. I mean, we need to find a way that students are not gaming East Campus, you know, driving in from their apartment on Grindstone, parking East Campus, and going to class. So I think this is all part of that. I understand Mr. Thomas says that this is part of it's being looked at. But I believe that parking tickets need to be considered accounts receivable. They need to be dated, and they need to be managed more aggressively. And people who are just not paying, if somebody's got three parking tickets over 90 days and they get a fourth one, it ought to be automatically either a boot put on or towed on the spot. And why this is important is that I know the paper made a point, it's $900,000. Well, the budget says that the municipal court costs $750,000, and the enforcement division cost $200,000. So $950,000, you know, breaks even. You know, we don't make any money on that. But if we're leaving $400,000 a year on the table, and we might be, I don't know. If we are, it's four cops. So I think this is something that given the stress constraints on the general fund and public safety, I'd like to see this followed up on, and I'd like to see this managed more aggressively.
I agree with all of that, Bob. And this was addressed at the workshop, and you were a part of that, and Mike and Carl. And then one of the messages that I got from the parking audit workshop was that if you don't do a good job of enforcement, the whole kind of system starts to fail, and people expect not to have to pay their parking tickets. And the first thing is to really tighten up enforcement. One of the suggestions that we were told was quite successful was actually if somebody gets a ticket for the first time, and I assume you can check that with the license plate and the database of previous fines, actually give them a free pass, or even give them a free cup of coffee at a nearby coffee shop and say, but next time it's going to be this amount of fine, and then the time after that it's going to go up substantially. and really make those second and third offenses much more expensive, and that is a really effective way to reduce failure to comply with paying a parking fine. Now, we do have, I believe, a policy on towing when somebody has. How exactly does that currently work?
Well, I would characterize it as fairly lenient compared to other cities. So we give everyone a warning. So after your fourth ticket, we will give you 24 hours notice that we're going to tow your car. Most people move their car then. And
do they have to pay the fine, the four fines that they haven't paid?
Well, it's due, but if they move it, we can't tow it, right? And then
so we just lose all the...
So we have to find it again to be able to tow it.
And then you do it without the 24 hours notice, I hope.
Yes. Once the notice is given, we can do it. Oh. Now, I believe you can get more aggressive in Missouri. So what we need to do is analyze our collection, our enforcement side, and come back to you with recommendations on how we might improve on that side. And we'll do that. I do know that Missouri has some nuance that other states don't about that enforcement, but I do believe that we could be more aggressive. I will just point out and then take more questions. We used to have $5 tickets for parking, so we have a history of being very lenient. $15, what it is now, is also extremely low compared to most cities.
Do we have any idea if they're paid more promptly since they're a higher ticket now? I don't have any of that data either.
We can we can measure that and come back to you.
Yeah, we need to have that.
Yeah.
Am I correct? The way this process works, I mean, when a tow is involved, it also requires a police presence. Is that right? That was my understanding when we were talking about parking utilities, that the parking utility people are not authorized to intervene and get a tow truck. And that's what I was told anyway. Maybe let me ask you that question.
That's what I was told too,
If they are, that cuts to the question. You know, we're always talking about more police officers and we're all understaffed and they are reactive and all the rest of it. But this is another one of those things, kind of those policy matters to make sure that we can get the revenue in that will generate enough money to provide for more police officers. It's kind of like the chicken and the egg thing. And if that's true, then that will be a higher dedication rate towards towing for the police department than we now have. So that may be an extra burden. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I agree with my colleagues. We really ought to enforce it. But that was my understanding, and if I'm wrong, I would like to know that.
We'll try to answer that, too.
Jim Charlier, the parking consultant who came into the workshops, he said that enforcement should be friendly and certain. And he recommended a graduated increase to, you know, so that you're not, you know, for an inadvertent slip up, you don't get the hammer laid down, but that it goes up, goes up quickly to improve.
Well, I think right now it's, having just gotten one last week, it's $15 if you paid in the first 15 days, and then it goes to $30.
That's right.
And that gets my attention. The $5 ones, I was like, well, I'll get around to paying it, but it's like, okay, I'll be getting this in.
But it's not just that. It's that if you then get another parking ticket a few weeks later, mm-hmm. it's not $15 going to 30, but it's 30 going to 50 or something the next time around. And that those rates should be well publicized so that everybody knows that the longer you continue to ignore them, the worse it gets.
But Mike makes a point that it used to, not that long ago, it was $5. And so, you know, I'm from Berkeley, California, so everything looks really cheap here. But that's not people's perspective. Some people think, you know, parking tickets are outrageously high because they've been trained to have them be $5. And plus, you know, I was down in Jefferson City and it, you know, I put like, I don't know, I was there for hours and it costs like 40 cents. So we have to look at kind of what people are used to. I mean, folks who are from bigger cities are used to this being a lot higher, but some people are, you know, I might be aghast at already. We're seeming unfriendly with our greedy $15 tickets. So
know. And the chatter is out there. A lot of chatter is out there that, you know, with this almost a million dollar windfall, that we're making a profit as a government agency, which is kind of silly. I mean, this is.
Well, I think that people need to understand that just covers the cost of municipal court, and it covers the cost of enforcement that we are making at $950,000. We're breaking even. We're not going into the general fund. But what for me is, I just want to make sure we're not leaving money on the table from people who are violating our rules and regulations. And I'd love to be able to hire another couple cops on increased collections. The next report is 98, our natural legacy scoring metrics for land preservation and acquisition.
Yes, last year we entered an agreement with the Greenbelt Land Trust to continue the implementation actions of our natural legacy plan. There were five key deliverables. They've completed those. We will return to council with a presentation in January 19th of a list of the properties to seek council direction on which way to go, because some of the factors are, kind of up to council. For example, we'd rather have a 30-acre tract in Columbia that's in the heart of the city for $600,000, or 120-acre tract that's a little further outside or right on the edge of Columbia for the same price. So those are the kind of the things that we need to seek some council direction on before we proceed with the actual acquisition.
Just a question. While we're at it, can we ask the Environment Energy Commission to weigh in on some of this, whether or not they may or may not have some recommendations? The council, they're one of our advisory bodies, and it would be helpful just to have extra. I don't want it to take this any longer than it needs to be, but just notify them that that they can take a look at some of these things in preparation for your presentation to the city council.
Sure, we'd be glad to share this report with them.
Sure.
We'd like to, because we're going to closed session on the 19th, because it is talking about land acquisition.
Well, not that detail. I mean, the extent okay. to which we talk about some of these projects and so on, you don't have to go into the amounts or anything that would be necessarily closed. But.
We can do that.
Thank you. 99 is the Vision Commission Media Mentions Report, which is informational. Are there any questions about 99? And 100 is interdepartmental transfer of funds requests. Are there any questions? If not, we'll move to general comments by the public. I'll yield 3 minutes to anyone who wants to speak about anything.
Anchor 1829 Cliff Drive. I got here late. Did you guys not do R16315?
We did not.
Was it tabled or withdrew?
It was withdrawn.
Okay. And in regards to a problem that I've spoke to you before in regards to a water leak on William Street, we're getting conflicting reports as to where the cause is. I hope that Public Works would do something at least by the summer. Right now, it's really hard to do it because all the traffic seems to have increased on Williams because of the safety project on College. And so I hope we can direct Public Works to look at this. At one time, we were told this was not chlorinated water. Then it was chlorinated water. Then it wasn't chlorinated water. Then a person six or seven houses up was blamed for it. Now there's another person being blamed for it. And what really needs to happen is it needs to be dug up. It needs to be dug up and find out where this water is coming from and what the source is. So I hope you'll address that. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is John Conway. I live at 4902 Thornbrook Bridge. I'm chairman of your Water and Light Advisory Board. And I'm here this evening to report that depreciation is live and well in the Water and Light Department, and that this is documented in the 2015 budget. The depreciation has been expensed in the water budget as well as in the light budget. In the water budget, it's about $2.7 million. And then the electric budget is about $14.7 million, and that it is expensed, and that you would need to know that as we meet the budget in 2015, it's very apparent that the water system has done very well, and so that will we'll realize that expense. And the electric department has done medium. It's not, but it also meet budget, and so those monies will flow to the bottom line since it's been expensed, and we know that since they've been expensed that we don't pay them to anybody except ourselves, and so if we don't pay them to anybody, it flows to the bottom line, and that it will go, it will lose its identity as depreciation to cash reserves, and then it goes into the cash reserves, into the balance sheet for each enterprise, and then it'll fall into the assets, and then it'll be a either a restricted asset if it's for CIP, and if it's just cash reserves to meet the cash reserve policy, then it'll be an unrestricted reserves. And that there were some, I attended the pre-council session from the last council meeting, and it seemed that there was some confusion as to depreciation account or fund and so on, and that I think we would stand with the finance director in his response. Anyway, I wanted to report that to you, that that is it's alive and well and working, and that provides money for our CIP as well as for replacements and so on. Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll move to council comments. Anyone down there?
I do, actually. Have two things.
Staff usually goes first. Do you have comments to make?
If I may, I'll jump in, and yes, then if there are any questions. And thanks to Councilmember Peters for asking me to say this. So you had a couple of contacts, and I think others may have too, with questions about the citizen handbook that was recently mailed to every residential address in the community. So I just want to make a couple comments for the public and about why that decision was made and what it cost and who printed it. So it did cost $63,000 for the whole project. That's about a dollar per household where we mailed the handbook. And then the question really becomes, well, why did you decide to mail it? You know, it would be so much cheaper if you just threw it on the website or printed 1,000 copies, and if people wanted them, they could have them. And while that's absolutely true, of course, that would be cheaper, and that is what we've done in the past. It doesn't actually communicate with anyone, and I'm exaggerating to make the point. The same people who have an iPad and an interest in the city and will actually search for a link and read it are also the people who subscribe to the paper, and they also subscribe to cable. And so that's, you've just heard every way we have to communicate with the public. And what we realize is when we added all that up is we only reach, if we use all of those venues, we only reach about 1% of the community with the website. We reach maybe a potential of 20% with the other venues. And so when we think about proactively communicating with everyone in the community about what we did with the money they gave us last year, really there's only one method that we can count on that really does reach every household, and that's the good old U.S. mail. So that's why we made the decision to go that route in a previous budget, and for a cost of about a dollar household, we felt like that's actually a really good buy to be able to do that communication. The other thing that comes up is there are folks that criticize how good it looks. it's too fancy, you know, and how, you know, surely you wasted money on that. But the fact is we have tremendous art in Columbia, and we felt like if we showcase some of that in the report, that it's most likely that people will at least pause before they throw it in the recycle bin and maybe even put it on the coffee table and hopefully read it at some point. And so that's why there's art in the book, is to give it folks a reason to open it when it says something from the city government is here. So that's all of the thinking behind it in a nutshell, and I just want to share that with you.
Can I just ask a question? I mean, that's a compelling presentation, and I appreciate it. I, for one, appreciate that outreach, because there are a lot of folks that don't avail themselves of some of the and frankly, some people that only communicate when they see something in print, if you will. What is the plan? Is this supposed to be an annual kind of thing, or is that what the
yes.
future plans are?
Really, it's a combination. It is the state of the city. Sort of condensed, combined with something maybe more useful, and that is the citizen handbook, right? What are the rules about garbage, and how do you find the phone numbers for whatever service you might want, and lots of other things. Basically, an overview of every service the city provides. But really, what we're looking forward to in future years is reporting out our progress on the strategic plan. And that's what the first performance report piece of that, it really is. And so that's the state of the city, the state of our efforts at implementing the strategic plan, combined with any other reason you might have a question about city government services.
How did we get it so cheap? I was challenged by the number that I just said I'm being lied to.
Right.
Because the price is pretty low.
There's two explanations for that, and I felt the same way the first time I did this. What? Two reasons. One, the printer is the university, and they've already made the investment in the big machines to be able to print at that volume. And so it's not like we're trying to print that ourselves. We wouldn't have the capacity. It would cost us more to do it ourselves than it does for someone who's really in the industry. A Kinko's could do it too, for example, at that. They have the big machines. But the real cost savings comes from how we deliver it. So we didn't have to put any postage on it. There's a bulk rate you can pay the post office where they know, and you have it indicated as such on the mailer, that they just put one in every box on their route. And so what you do is deliver whole pallets to a truck, and they just put one with everything that goes. So they don't have to spend the time to sort it and send it.
So that explains why it came to someone's house, came to someone's business, because they just, every place got one.
Yes.
Answered all of the mysteries of the citizen handbook. Or the no good deed shall go unpunished.
That's right. I hope that was helpful.
Any more, Dr. Peters? Anything else?
Oh, yeah. I have two issues. One was there was a report that the City Council got on October 20th of 2014 about backflow valves in the sewer system. And I wondered if we could get an update on that, a staff update on that report, or what we need to do to move forward. I think there was some discussion about trying to help the property owners and taking care of those backflow valves. I'm told it was sort of dropped, I guess, in the midst of other things. And then the other question is just the Red Bull street closure that came and went. What should be the process for that coming to the City Council? Because that just sort of showed up as new business, and it looked like it was something that we were going to vote on, and yet it wasn't listed before. So is there a process for that?
Well, the reason it showed up was we missed taking it off as a staff. So if the staff says no to a request to close the street, they have the right to appeal it to council. And in an abundance of customer service, we assumed they were going to and put it on the agenda. But then when they failed to do that, it just didn't come off. And partly, many of us were at a conference that week, and so it was kind of a skeleton crew, and we just erred in not pulling it off before it was printed.
Okay. And then a follow-up question to that is there a mechanism to notify neighborhoods that someone's asking for a street closure, and is that part of the
That's part of the reason we said no. Yes, they are supposed to notify the affected street that they're wanting to go on, especially if you close it for a parade. So for many reasons, we did not feel comfortable approving that event.
If it had shown up on the city council agenda, is there a requirement to have notified the neighborhood associations for that?
No, not for the council agenda. We assume that the agenda is public and that they will find out that way. But there's no obligation on the part of the city or the applicant once it goes on a council agenda to then again notify them.
But they should have been notified.
Should have been notified that they were working on an application.
Okay.
Right,
the
joint, thank you.
Just the adjoining property owners.
Is that subject to the 175-foot rule, or is that just planning and zoning? That's just planning and zoning.
Right, this is just the adjoining. So the ordinance was really made for downtown, where, you know, you're just going to the businesses that adjoin that street. This was a little different because they changed their mind and then really tried to get into a residential space, which our ordinance just don't intend for that to happen. And there were many reasons we said no, but that is one.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's it.
I've got a couple of things. We established the Youth Advisory Council about 6 months ago, following a lot of activity by a number of high school students, including organizing a youth issues conference at the ARC, and one of the leaders of this group, Sloan Scott, attending the National League of Cities conference last year as a youth delegate and coming back with a lot of, you know, great information and a network. And she, Sloan Scott, is now, I think, the chair of the Youth Advisory Council this year. The group spent their first three meetings. There were a number of capacity building activities that were facilitated by Matt Luchtman with the Columbia Public Schools, and discussions of topics of interest which they want to work on, which include youth violence and crime and drug abuse, transportation options. A number of the original members for that first period graduated from high school in May and left the council, and we have appointed replacements for them, and the group is now getting started to work on its 2015-16 agenda. Several of the youth have expressed an interest in attending the National League of Cities Conference again this year, which is in Nashville the first week of November. Laura and I have discussed this, and we'd like to support their efforts to do so. The City Council has a travel budget to attend that conference, and several of us are using that. Heather Cole, who's been staffing the Youth Advisory Council, there are two students in particular who made very compelling cases that Laura and I reviewed. Heather estimates that the cost of their registration, travel, hotel, and per diem would come to about $3,000 for the two of them. There would also be a need for a chaperone to go, which would probably be a parent of one of them or parents of both of them. We wouldn't want to cover that cost, but I will make a motion to allocate $3,000 from our council reserves to support these two students to attend the National League of Cities in November.
And if I may just add, I'm not going to be able to attend the National League of Cities this year, so I will have unused travel funds, and so I would be willing to donate for one of those for my travel budget, if that's an allowable thing
to
do.
So it still requires council action.
Correct. It does, yeah. That would be very gracious, I think, because I thought you were going, and I know you were going, I'm going, and I was trying to convince Mr. Ruffin to go as well. This is very valuable stuff. I mean, anytime you can get, particularly anytime you can get the youth involved on this track and see what the connections are and the value of these kinds of things. It's incredibly valuable, and we're not going to be around forever, and these are the up-and-comers and so on and so forth. And to get them plugged into this kind of information, well, it's not free, but almost free information, invaluable stuff, is very worthwhile. And since Miss Nauser is going to be gracious and not be able to go and offer these kinds of monies, I see no reason why we shouldn't go ahead with this.
Well, I will be the lone dissenting vote because in a city, they can't afford enough firefighters and police. Symbolism is very important, and those people running for election, well, you're running for election, I'm not, so there's a lot of questions out there. We've had a lot of shots thrown at us about prioritizing our expenses. A lot of it's off track, I believe, but this is just another example of either demonstrating frugality or not. So I'll be the lone dissenting vote on this. So should we vote?
Wait, I need clarification.
Absolutely.
Mr. Thomas made a motion. I never heard a second. And
second.
Where's the money coming from?
So how much? See, I was going to go, and if I recall correctly, it was like around 1,700 what my registration and classes would have been.
So, I think I'll say it a different way. You normally travel from the council training budget, which I don't believe is council reserves.
Correct.
Correct.
So I think what your motion would be is take half of the $1,500 right. from training, but travel budget, $1,500 from council reserves.
Right.
Okay. That motion works
that.
For me.
It hasn't been seconded.
Okay. So Mr. Thomas made the motion. Mr. Scala seconded
second.
That. Okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. No. Who's next?
I got a couple more things. we had a presentation earlier about the red light cameras. I don't know if you can answer this now, Mike, or if it would be some research and come back to us, but I think the red light cameras are very important in terms of, much like parking tickets, ensuring that people obey the rules of the road, and in this case, create a safer community. I don't like the idea. I don't think that we have used them or would use them as revenue generators. I think we can demonstrate how we use the revenue, and it would be to more enforcement. But what I don't understand is why we have to partner with a private company to do this. What's the barrier to the City of Columbia purchasing the cameras, installing them ourselves, and having our staff review the film and issuing tickets on the basis of that?
I believe we could do that. It's really a cost factor. And so part of the partnership with this company is that they provided the equipment. They do the initial screen, and then what they send us is considered, you know, high-quality video resolution. And so I think something like 80% of the pictures got cut out at that point. I forget the exact number. And so what was left is for us then to do the final step, which is, you know, put the driver and the license plate together. So I believe we could do that, as you suggest. It was more of a cost avoidance, you know, mm-hmm. to do this partnership. So shared revenue. I will say, you know, they have lost money on our contract. It's not been a revenue generator. And so we only did 5 intersections anyway, and so it was the ones we felt were most problematic. We are preparing a presentation for council, and we will show you some of the worst video we've seen, school buses running red lights, stuff like that. So it's a real safety issue, and it has a dramatic impact on reducing red light running mm-hmm. when you have these cameras. So it's in that regard, it definitely works. They're very effective. Now I think you can criticize other places for turning them into revenue sources. We have not done that. It's not been.
If we do implement this again, and I hope we do, I'd like us to be able to very transparently demonstrate that the money raised, how that money raised from the fines is utilized, so that we can answer those critics. And then I had one last thing, referring back to the other two scheduled public comments at the beginning of this evening's meeting, and just want to really validate what Tracy and Julie were saying. I feel like I'm going through an epiphany on race relations and discrimination in Colombia and throughout the United States. I visited the International Museum of Slavery when I was back in England in the spring, which is in Liverpool. It's a fairly new museum. I've really started reading the history of Africans in America and how that started and how it has gone on. And I really admire what the Race Matters people are doing in pushing this issue. It's hard, but it's a real issue, and the solutions are not easy. But one of the solutions that was mentioned, one of the steps in the right direction, is looking at the way our police department operates. Want to thank Chief Burton for sending me the curriculum for the procedural justice training that he and 28 other officers, supervisors, took in August. And that looks like a very good kind of training in the issues of fair policing and building a culture in the department that encourages fair policing in the community. I was out of town for a few days this week, or end of last week, and came back and reading the papers. And one headline just sort of struck me as I was kind of going through the papers, which I think we should all really think about, and that is white silence is violence. And it's far too easy, as at least one of the speakers mentioned today, for middle-class white people to comfortably go through our lives and feel like we're doing the right thing there and thereabouts, and not really try to understand the issues that a lot of people in this community and communities all over the country experience. And when we start investigating that, then I think we're compelled not to be silent anymore.
Well, I didn't start out with too many things, but I've accumulated a couple, a couple more, I should say. There is the group, the real group that you refer to, is doing very valuable work. There is another real group that I encountered at a recent National League of Cities University Leadership Conference, and that real group is called Racial Equity and Leadership. It's a new group that was established last year at the National League of Cities that I've been invited to sit on, and we'll be doing that in November. I hope to bring some of that to the City Council through maybe one of the work sessions, because there's lots of ideas that they have, I think, that could be useful to all of us in these groups that we're talking about. And that kind of fits into the mayor's comment about, yes, some of you are standing for election, and he's going to be frugal about professional development. I submit that some of this professional development is a way to break through this parochial barrier that we have in this town, that any idea that's not hatched here has to be a bad idea. There are a tremendous amount of connections and an investment in the kinds of professional development that mean to us that we can bring back solutions, we can even bring back stories about failures and prevent the kinds of failures in policy that other communities have paid dearly for. That's valuable information. And in terms of the amount of money that we're talking about here, to spend $1,500 out of a travel budget, that's not going to get you much of a police officer, frankly. I would love to have more police officers. We tried that last November. It didn't quite work. Maybe we asked for too much. I suspect we did. But the fact of the matter is that you're talking about $100,000 a year, a $2 million career for a police officer. That is a far cry from $1,500, and the graciousness that Ms. Nauzer showed by donating or contributing her funds to the youth that are trying to follow us to provide some solutions to our community. I think it's a valuable investment, and I would defend it to the hilt and continue to do that. Now let me get down to a couple of other things that I had lined up anyway. I'm sorry that Mr. Shanker left, because I wanted to follow up and ask the city manager if he was aware, or if Public Works was aware, of some of the story that he was talking about on William Street, because I didn't know some of the background in terms of this chlorinated water and non-chlorinated. That part of the conversation I was not in on. But I want to make sure that there is a follow-up, that if this needs some attention, that it just doesn't persist, and at least to take a look at it to make sure that it's on the list, on the agenda, or is in line for being fixed.
I'll just have a real quick response. We have located at least one break. There may be more. And it is between the water system and the house, so it's a private water break. And that owner, I does know about it and has committed to fix it. I don't know if that repair has happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just a follow-up would be useful. Sure. And just a comment with regard to the red light cameras. I think Ms. Nauser and I probably, at the outset, when this red light camera thing first came up, and that was under the leadership of the former mayor, it was always a 4-3 decision, I believe, that the red light cameras were established. The two of us voted against this on a number of occasions, but at a minimum, and I'm open to listening as to whether or not this really does provide public safety. I even jokingly offered the option of maybe we ought to just have one camera and move it around to various places. It'd be a lot cheaper than putting real cameras all over the place. But and no one really took that seriously, I don't think. But nonetheless, what I would like to see with red light cameras is at least the data for the intersections that we had to find out just exactly what happened at those intersections, the ones that we monitored and the number of tickets that were given and whether or not this accident data is really available to be able to judge whether or not we ought to extend this program or not.
That's precisely the information we're bringing.
Thank you. That's all I have.
So if you want to wait for me to go last, or I'll go now.
Go now.
Okay. I apologize. I've had quite a lot of active constituents, so I have 10 items. So
oh, my goodness.
I even had to type them up so I wouldn't forget. And interestingly enough, one of them is on the front page of the Tribune tonight, and that is College Avenue. I had actually Jenny Chadwick, the previous first floor council person, talk about some of the safety hazards of those hawk crossings. And so after glancing at the article, is there a way to with those lights to where somebody doesn't have to necessarily push the button, that have a sensor, so if somebody is standing in that vicinity that those lights start to flash rather than waiting for, because I was just saying where it says some people say if there's no traffic they just dart across the street, yeah, as opposed to pushing the signal, which they should always push the signal and be in that habit. So I don't know if there's a way that there's a sensor mechanism that would automatically flash when a pedestrian is standing in a certain vicinity to that signal, putting that out there
for
staff to investigate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then another constituent brought up the issue again on Providence Road with the transit system about people having to get on and off the bus on Providence Road, off on the shoulder, especially in the evenings where there's potentially not adequate light. And so they asked if maybe those routes could be changed somewhat so that people, riders, could get on and off where allowed on the outer road rather than on Providence. And then my next thing is Mr. Thomas and I believe it was last week or the week before that, went and talked with people to get the conversation started on our sidewalk repair issue. And I think one of the things I heard at that meeting was, is we really need to know the conditions of our sidewalks throughout our community. And so I'm asking staff to begin looking at developing a sidewalk needs matrix so that we know exactly what part of town the major where the repairs are, and you know, rank those repairs on maybe the highest need to something that, you know, maybe should be on a radar and taken care of within a couple of years. I think we'll have more credibility talking about our sidewalk repairs if we know the exact extent of our needs rather than just trying to extrapolate it from these are the repairs we've done in the past versus how many miles of sidewalks we have, because I don't think anybody at that meeting felt buy-in to that approach to saying what our needs truly are. The other day I was over by Parkade, or the Moberly Area Community College on Parkade, I believe it's Parkade Boulevard, and I know I had brought this up before about the potholes in the street. I think that was just through general email correspondence, but the road has been fixed. But it's not fixed. I felt like I was driving on a lunar landscape. So whoever repaired that roadway certainly did not level the road or go over it with anything, because it is now very bumpy, for lack of a better description. So if staff could go over there and check that out, if that was done by a private contractor, I would certainly think that we need to have it redone. And then I've had several people over the years contact me, and I think I had an email again about the proliferation of these flag signs, the proliferation of we buy used cars, flu shots today, you name it, in our right-of-ways that people are, I mean, you drive down Nifong and there's signs all over Nifong now advertising some kind of service. And again, the proliferation of people that are standing out dancing and twirling billboard signs at some of these places. And so if we can start to look at that process, I know they've presented a potential amendment to our sign ordinance that they've asked for maybe planning and zoning to start to look at. But I have seen, a proliferation of those flag signs that aren't being used temporarily. They're being used permanently that advertise, names of places, et cetera, which, certainly is kind of skirting our sign ordinance. Then I had several weeks back, I had talked to Public Works and provided Mr. Glasscock an invoice from a constituent of mine that was close to $13,000 for some stormwater repairs to her property, and this is over in Highlands. It's off of Brookdale Court in Elston. There's two elderly widow ladies who are having stormwater problems because apparently there was stormwater backing up on Highlands Parkway. We cut an inlet to relieve that problem of the water backing up on Highlands Parkway, and in doing so now have pushed all that water into their property. And so this one elderly woman has received a bid for $13,000 to fix the stormwater, and staff had said they were going to look at that issue, and they haven't been contacted. So if I would like to know where they are in that issue. I'm sorry. Then I have another constituent who is upset that she doesn't feel that she's been trying to work with Ready, and she's had several communications with them, but was asking if they have some kind of database that sends individuals who have contacted them about entrepreneurial opportunities when they have seminars or workshops, if they keep notice of all the individuals who have contacted them, that something may be useful to them if they contact people within the community. She says that she found out about some kind of seminar that would have been applicable to her because she was a woman. It was about women entrepreneurs, and she didn't know about it except she happened to read it, I think, maybe in a publication in the newspaper. So if, I think as an outreach, if, that might be something Ready could do to continue to provide support and services to people that they might not necessarily be able to help, but certainly can provide them information. Then I had a call from a gentleman over at Stony Creek Inn. That roadway, that outer roadway, is very dark and dangerous, and there's a lot of student housing over there in that area. And apparently a lot of students are walking up and down that roadway in the evenings with no place to walk and no lights. So if I could have staff look at if there's a potential to maybe put in a couple of street lights or maybe just put in some kind of interim shoulder, just would be at least a walking path for those people, because they're walking down the hill to cross over Providence to get to the university or down to the, the reactor field. And I think they've got the tennis courts and that down in that area. The bridge has obviously the sidewalks, but that windy road that goes through the trees, it's still kind of, it's wooded over in that area, so it hasn't been developed. So it's rather dangerous for people to be walking at night. I have a list here of sidewalk gaps that a homeowners association in my ward has asked for city assistance on getting cooperation from residents. So I will hand in those street addresses at the request of the Homeowners Association. I presume I might be getting one or two more related to that. And then last but not least, the transmission lines has been an issue that has been brought back up again. Have a lot of angry and upset constituents. There's a meeting going on this evening. I don't know if they're done or with it or not over at the PTA meeting at Mill Creek. But anyway, I'm asking staff if they could please provide council with a staff report on the history and the future timeline of the Southwest Transmission Project. And in that, if you can include project history, including the dates and places of the IP meetings and public hearings, potential issues, if anything, are applicable to our bond rating and funding should a new route be determined, benefits versus cost of option A versus option B, impact of changing the scope of the project to option B, and then the timeline of the project, including the second phase of the project, which will connect to McBain, down High Point Lane. For some reason, most people think that that section of the power lines is off the table. Somehow Dr. Stiepelman was successfully able to keep those power lines away from Rockbridge Elementary. So I have this all in a list, and I appreciate council indulging me to go over 10 items, and I will be quiet now.
Trapp?
I think that's a record, Ms. Mauser.
It is.
I have 11. No, I have one. I had a constituent who called the utility, and he felt like he had a long wait, and then he was disconnected, and then he had a long wait. And he said that he routinely calls, he's a landlord, about utility issues and gets a long wait on the phone. So I just wondered how our wait times are for the utility.
I can speak to that a little bit. You approved the addition of 2 call takers for that exact purpose in the recent budget.
So I love it.
Should be getting better. There is a, if you look at that issue from our customer service standards, there is an unacceptable delay for folks calling. And, of course, in our community, we have massive move-in and move-out days. And so, you know, if you're calling in August, expect some wait time. But it carries throughout that. So it's we hope to be significantly better at getting to phone calls.
Right. That's like 2 in a row. I called and said, what about Sylvie Lane? And then they paved it the next day.
Tell you, I've got to take the gimmies. That's right.
We're on that. We're hiring people. We've got to do better. Thank you.
Dr. Ruffin, your 12 issues?
I wish. The only thing I have to say is that we're continuing to work with the Columbia Alliance to Combat Homelessness. We're meeting with neighborhood associations tomorrow evening at 6:30 at Jefferson Junior High School to share our vision and hear their concerns and answer their questions as well. So we're just moving forward with that project, and I believe it will come before the council at the next meeting.
I'm last. I will... I promised that I would cease and desist talking about my criticisms of electric billing in the city of Columbia. So I will hold to that promise. However, the Missouri Economic Research and Information Center, you've seen this article in the paper about our cost of living, and the we're at $97.50. Higher than any other city in Missouri, but still obviously hundreds is the national average. But our utility costs were $106.10. So we now have a director of utilities, don't we? I personally think the city owes an explanation to the cities, to the citizens, as to why our utility costs exceed those of other cities in the state of Missouri. You may choose to follow up on that or not, but were I running for election, I would make that an issue. But I'm not running for election, so I won't. Anything else? Meeting's adjourned.
It's not midnight. I was trying to make it midnight with all my...